Hey, Penknife listeners, if you like what you're hearing and want to help us out, the best thing you can do right now is to rate and review Penknife on Apple Podcasts, subscribe on whatever platform you're using to listen to us right now, and, of course, tell your friends about it. Thank you.
On June 18th, 1932, Fahlerer's new novel, Little Man, What Now?, is released in serial form in Berlin's prestigious Vossische Zeitung newspaper and will eventually be serialized in over 50 provincial papers. In its first 2 years, it will sell 500,000 copies, be translated into 7 languages, and receive 2 film adaptations, 1 German, 1 American.
During Fahlerer's lifetime, it will be far and away his best-selling book and catapult him from being an author of note to one of Germany's most popular and celebrated novelists.
Is it because it's far and away better than his other books?
Not quite. Fahlerer himself doesn't understand its success and actually calls it one of his weaker novels, claiming that A Small Circus was much better. It's not my favorite of his novels. There's 2 or 3 I'd place above it, but I pretty much loved every page, start to finish. Well, save the last few pages, which we'll get to shortly. But the real reason Lucky Hans's novel was such a massive hit wasn't because it was so much better than his other books. The real reason was, drumroll please, luck.
It was a case of the right time, right place, a zeitgeist novel, if you will, like Bonfire of the Vanities for the 80s, or a more contemporaneous and similar example would be another Depression-era classic, Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath.
For me, Bret Easton Ellis wrote the novel of the 80s, American Psycho.
I'm pretty sure that came out in 91.
Fine. Less than zero, then.
Okay. While there are contenders for 80s US zeitgeist novels, there's no competition in early 30s Germany. There's just Little Man, which chronicles the country's grim financial crisis, and in particular the plight of the white-collar, middle-class worker. From late 1929, just before the Wall Street crash, to mid-1932 when Little Man was released, unemployment rose from 1.4 to 6 million people. That's 1 in every 3 Germans without work. And those who were working lost about 50% of their wages.
So with so many people suffering, it's no wonder why a pretty straightforward novel about 2 young people falling in love, getting married and having a kid, all the while desperately struggling to put food on the table, is such a success. Add to that Fahlerer's highly accessible writing style, which foregoes any authorial flourishes in order to mainline the reader directly into the story, and you've got a novel with universal appeal.
And this time you've also got heroes. The young man, Pinnenberg, and his wife, Lamchen. They're continually faced with economic ruin, hunger, and homelessness, and yet their love for each other and their baby, plus their will to survive, is enough to overcome one seemingly insurmountable obstacle after another.
Yeah, they're both really well-written characters. Although between them, if you had to choose the hero, it would obviously be Lamchen, who's the real bedrock of the family, and manages to keep her bumbling, foolhardy husband in line. Pinnerberg's bumbling foolhardiness is the giveaway that he's a stand-in for our guy, Fahlerer.
Yeah, almost every Fahlerer novel has a very clear stand-in for the author, and in this one it's Pinnerberg.
He's also pretty representative of a lot of men. At one point he inspires his wife to have the thought, all men are cowards.
Well, I'm not going to argue with that. Pinnenberg, like Fahlerer, like me, was definitely a bit of a coward. It was probably that trait that most endeared him to his readers. In other words, he was suffering like everyone else. And like everyone else, he also often acted like a suffering man does. He was impulsive, prideful, occasionally callous, and often acted against his own best interests. Pinnenberg, the little man, is basically the quintessential Fahlerian character. There's none of your usual salt-of-the-earth working-class heroism in Pinnenberg. He's just a little weak man with a big heart getting carried downstream in the current, doing his best to grasp onto something, anything.
Fahlerer, of course, is not the first to have depicted poor people with complexity. Dickens' poor, for instance, are not all angels. They bring much of their suffering upon themselves. What's new about Little Man and what I think makes the book so relevant today is that it's not about the working class. It's about the middle class, who were completely vanishing in Germany in this period. In 1930, the Frankfurt school writer Siegfried Krakauer published a study on white-collar workers that Fahlerer reads while writing Little Man. In it, Krakauer writes, "The mass of white-collar workers differs from the industrial proletariat in that they are intellectually homeless. They cannot connect with the proletarian comrades, and the haven of the middle-class values and feelings where they once lived has collapsed. They live without tenets that they can respect, without a goal they can ascertain."
So you're saying that Fahlerer's book is relevant to contemporary society because the disappearance of the middle class in Weimar Germany is akin to the disappearance of the middle class today?
Yeah, and what it means to be part of the working poor is very different as well.
Right. Like when you worked at a factory or at McDonald's or something, you'd work 9 to 5 or the graveyard shift or whatever. Now jobs live inside the computer. You never clock out and you're always on call, as there's always another website that needs copy editing or cheeseburger that needs delivering.
Time is right for the Zeitgeist novel of the gig economy.
Absolutely. And I already have the title. It goes, slightly high challenge person, it's obviously okay to not do anything and just be. But if you feel comfortable doing so, we want you to know that this is a safe space to tell us what you'd be interested in doing next.
My name is Ramona Stout, and I'm height challenged and all too well acquainted with the gig economy. I'm a writer who spends much of her time writing impassioned green card applications for those who want to make a life in a country I have no faith in.
I'm Corey Eastwood, a writer and bookseller from New York who's not cut out for the gig economy. The last time I had a job that wasn't selling books was 20 years ago when DVDs were still a thing and I used to bike around Manhattan delivering them.
And I'm Santiago Lemoine. And while I agree the gig economy sucks, it's just as bad as the other gig economy. Rapping in Jerzy Kuzinski's voice in a nearly empty bar, not being paid and getting yelled at by the bar owner because you don't bring enough people to the show. Anyway, you're listening to Penknife, a podcast about writers who may or may not have written about crime, but who definitely committed it.
Little Man What Now, which is very much based on Falada's own money troubles and struggles to provide for his family, is written during a feverish 4-month period beginning in 1931. While he begins the book sober, he's drinking by the time he completes it. And the thing about drug use, the lesson Falada will learn again and again in his lifetime, is that when you substitute your primary drug for one that's less destructive, the less destructive one usually gets you high enough, or low enough as it may be, to convince you to go back to the one you were avoiding in the first place.
So what leads him back to the drink? Well, for Falada, like many or all writers, alcoholic or non, the writing itself is like a drug. He says of writing,
"It was often like an intoxication, but one above all the forms of intoxication that material substances can deliver. Even the worst hours, when I was in utter despair about how to continue the novel, were far better than my most beautiful free hours. No, that's what it was. I had taken a poison that I could not shake out of my mind or my body. I was thirsty for it. I wanted to drink more of it. To drink it always, every day, for the rest of my life."
It's passages like these that make me love Falada so much and recommend his books more highly than any other writer we've chronicled on this show so far, my beloved Mr. Kaczynski included. There it is. He basically sums up my existence with that passage. I used to love to drink, but the drug I always loved more than any other was writing. There was and remains no better elsewhere to lose yourself in than your own writing.
Ah yes, the sweet elixir that is falling in love with your own voice. Truly so much like the self-involvement of substance abuse, no?
And when he finishes the book, the come down from the writing high isn't easy. Add to that, the success of Little Man begins to bring him plenty of spending money for the first time in his adult life, and one of his favorite things to spend it on is alcohol.
Sober Hans is again Drunky Drunk Hans.
To escape his addiction, he pulls the classic alcoholic geographic, and in the fall of 32, he moves to the country, where he can't be tempted by Berlin's dance halls and cabarets.
Except that, contrary to popular belief, at least amongst alcoholic city dwellers, they do have booze in the country, lots of it, and when he wants to go on a real bender, Berlin isn't that far.
But escaping temptation is not the only reason he leaves. Street fights between Nazis and communists are commonplace, and things are deteriorating quickly. In January of 1933, Adolf Hitler is appointed chancellor. In February, the Reichstag burns, and now it's open season on all enemies of the Nazis.
Now's the time to go, and many artists and intellectuals make haste. Among them is legendary composer Kurt Weill, who'd been set to do the score of the German film version of Little Man, What Now?
But Falada stays, thinking his farm up north will be far enough away from the turmoil in Berlin. He also thinks that people are being paranoid, and that while Nazi rhetoric might be scary, they'll never be able to implement it. On April 7th, when, quote, all non-Aryan and unreliable elements were to be removed from holding public jobs, Falada isn't affected, and of this period, he later writes,
"We kept telling ourselves, it doesn't affect us. We're peace-loving citizens. We have never been politically active. We really were very stupid, precisely because we had not been politically active, i.e. had not joined the One True Party and did not do so now, we made ourselves highly suspect.
Like its predecessor, A Small Circus, Little Man What Now brings to life some of the various political strains of the day through characters who champion, variously, communism, social democracy, and national socialism. By far the most unsympathetic character amongst them is the Nazi S.A. Brownshirt, who's described as a, quote, short, fat, flaxen-head stump of a man with enormous hands, whose low IQ and affinity for street fighting leads him to join the Nazis.
Falada says he's never been politically active, but here's an example of how difficult, or sometimes impossible, it is not to be politically active in such a highly charged political context.
Not entirely dissimilar from today, when someone can think of themselves as apolitical, but then they unwittingly make an ignorant comment on Twitter that many see as very political, and then they're cancelled.
The Nazis like the fact that the book is again critical of the Weimar government, but obviously dislike the portrayal of their SA guy. But the communist criticism is more fascinating. A major attack of the novel from their side is that it provides no answer to the question, what now? Instead of joining the communists, the Nazis, or anyone else, the characters retreat to the countryside where they seem to sort of overcome their hardships by the strength of individual will and the love of their family.
I guess the commies wanted it to end like Upton Sinclair's classic, The Jungle, a similarly moving book about the struggles of the little man that ends with a final chapter that is essentially one big socialist propaganda speech.
Yeah, that was never in the cards for Falada. He was intuitively distrustful of all politics. While I didn't want him to propose an answer to what now, the happy ending feels like a cop-out to me. After such a brutally honest depiction of the time, that's the one part of the book that reads like fantasy.
You mean it's not possible in Germany in the early 30s to retreat to the countryside and live happily ever after?
That is what Falada does, isn't it? After, ever, happily? The old car is painfully slow and loud, rattling heavily as it moves along the small country road. Falada looks out the window at the pine trees and tries to assess the situation. There are four of them, thick and porcine, like all good SA brown shirts. There's nothing to do but look out the window and hope they take him directly to jail. Don't provoke, don't give them any reason for suspicion or anger. These people are capable of destroying him. That morning, when he saw them in the field behind his home, he knew there was trouble ahead. And even though the swarm of officials searching the house had looked everywhere, opened every drawer, gone through every letter, shaken every book, they hadn't found anything that could incriminate him. But that didn't stop them. The SA is always hungry for victims, and it's all the better if the person is innocent. And Falada could not be more innocent. Okay, he could, but they can't have anything on him. Some enemy must have made up some excuse to denounce him. There's no point in thinking about that now. The leader of the pack turns around and looks at him. The pallor of his face and amicable tone in his voice are perhaps even worse than the violence those things portend.
Are you comfortable back there?
He asks. Falada affirms his comfort with a bit too much verve, and all four of them chuckle as the driver begins to pull over. Of course. Here they are, in the middle of nowhere, where there's no one to hear his screams. The SA get out of the car and leave him there to imagine the worst. A few go to take a piss. They all light cigarettes. Now they're talking to each other in hushed tones. He doesn't need to hear their voices to know what they're saying. Shot while trying to escape. It doesn't matter that he's innocent and not trying to escape. He can just hear them.
Happens all the time with these people. They're always trying to escape, and we always have no choice.
And the paper won't even report it. And when Suze comes looking for answers, it'll be her husband who's to blame. So he sits there, an innocent man in this old car, parked on the side of the road at the edge of this barren forest. And when the leader of the brown shirts walks back towards the car and leans over, Falada knows exactly what he'll ask him.
Perhaps you'd like to get out of the car, stretch your legs.
Thank you, I'm fine. I don't need to get out. Nice and comfortable right here. But the brown shirt doesn't want to hear this. His jowly white face turns red, and he screams at Falada not to fuss and to just get out of the car. Okay, you don't want to go? There's a solution for that, and the three henchmen are called over to remove him. But if they're going to kill him, it will not be while trying to escape. So he grips the seat cushion tightly and hangs on for dear life. These men don't read, They're probably illiterate, but when they approach him like three snarling Rottweilers who've cornered a cat up against a wall, he can swear he hears one of them chuckle and say,
"Okay, little man, what now?"
Hans lives to see another day because, as luck would have it, at the moment that the brown shirts are beginning to pull him from the car, the Karwitz village doctor happens to be driving by. He pulls over and immediately realizes what's happening, and about to happen. So he waits around until the SA guy gets back in the car and drives Hans to jail.
Hans eventually finds out that it's his elderly neighbors slash tenants who've denounced him after they overheard him telling jokes about Nazis. His escape from death while trying to escape means he's taken to jail. And our hero, who's by no means a stranger to lockup, calls this one, quote, "the scurviest, most disgusting hole I had ever been in my entire life." And this is coming from a guy who, after he convinced the police to take him for his last embezzlement arrest, was put into a cell crawling with bedbugs.
This one sees your bedbugs. They're there in the moldy straw mattress in swarms and raises you an overflowing bucket of feces with a piss and shit puddle surrounding it that makes breathing near impossible.
During yet another trip to prison nearly a decade later, Falada will write of this experience.
"I just managed to escape almost certain death, and in a manner of speaking, I was now safe. Yet the outrage I felt about the pigsty they'd put me in outweighed everything else."
He's not nearly as angry at the brown shirts who tried to kill him as he is the cops who put him in here.
But he's not there long. He lucks out with a good lawyer who manages to get him out of jail, but the experience is a lesson. Justice, legality, human rights, these things do not apply in the Third Reich.
Less than a month after the incident, on April 10th, 1933, you have Nazi Germany's first mass book burning. The banned books that go up in flames include the work of Brecht, the Mann brothers, Stefan Zweig, Joseph Roth, and Erich Maria Remarque, among others. Falada's name is not on the list. His books survive the bonfires and remain in print.
But it's no surprise that when it's time for a new edition of Little Man to be printed at the end of 1933, Falada caves to the demands of Nazi censors and changes the horrible Nazi brown shirt into a, quote, "goalkeeper with violent tendencies."
That's great. He swaps the Nazi for a footballer. It makes sense, though. There's a long, proud tradition of football and fascism intermingling. Far-right parties often recruit their henchmen from squads of violent football hooligans, as chronicled in Bill Buford's masterpiece, Among the Thugs. In the 1980s, the National Front was deep inside the Man United hooligan scene.
And in the 90s, you had Milosevic using the Belgrade Red Star Ultras as a sort of paramilitary unit that committed atrocities throughout Croatia and Bosnia.
Those who criticize Falada for staying, even though he'll later claim he was always anti-Nazi, can point to this footballer change as one of the many examples of his complicity. His next book, Once a Jailbird, which you might guess from the title is an autobiographical account of a former prisoner struggling to make it on the outside before returning to crime, will also be used by his detractors to show that he did more than just stay in Nazi Germany. He collaborated.
The first edition of the book includes a foreword written by Falada himself that says that the ridiculous, grotesque, and pitiful consequences of the so-called humane justice system depicted in these pages are now a thing of the past because of how Germany has changed since he'd begun writing the novel, i.e., now that the Nazis are here, prisoners will finally be treated humanely.
Right, obviously. As a man who's been a Nazi prisoner, he's probably well-versed in the mercy and compassion they have for the people they incarcerate.
This Nazi placating is ugly, but understandable when you take into account that it's likely he wouldn't have been able to publish without these concessions. He's just moved to a new farm in Karwitz, a few hours north of Berlin, and he has a family to provide for. The plan is to be self-sustaining, so that if things get worse in the capital, they can just stay on their farm, eat their produce, and supplement it with the fish from the nearby streams, the rabbit that won't stop eating their cabbage, plus the occasional pig they slaughter and turn into bratwurst. Nice plan, but it requires money to get the farm in working order. When you factor in Falada's alcohol problem, which also costs money, then it really is publish or perish.
Or leave and publish freely and don't perish. Plenty of others did it.
Very good point. And it's the main question his critics ask. Why the hell doesn't he leave?
His 1944 prison diary, which is eventually published as a memoir, is essentially one long justification for staying. In it, he writes,
"I love Germany. What kind of German would I be if I had slunk away to a life of ease in my country's hour of affliction and ignominy? I was right to stay in Germany. I am German, and I would rather perish with this unfortunate but blessed nation than enjoy false happiness in some other country.
Wow.
Yep.
Seriously?
There's plenty of irony here. But one particularly glowing example is that even with its preposterously pandering forward, the novel Once a Jailbird, which is fundamentally humanist and anti-Nazi, ends up getting panned by the Nazi press and results in Falada being labeled anti-Deutsch or anti-German.
These are total tangents, but are you too familiar with the contemporary anti-Deutsch movement? It's a truly fascinating political strain that's deeply rooted in collective guilt. Basically, it's a sect of the German left, radical left even, that is so dedicated to anti-Semitism that it supports Zionism, and as a result, the State of Israel and the United States because they're Israel's BFF.
Yeah, it's crazy. I once had a German girlfriend whose roommate in Berlin was part of the Antifa radical left. But he was also such a dedicated anti-Deutsch that he literally had two massive flags hanging in his bedroom. Israel and the U.S.
What?
I shit you not.
Right. If you want to fight anti-Semitism, it makes total sense that you support murderous regimes because, of course, all Jews support Israel and the government's policies towards Palestine. It's mind-boggling.
It really doesn't make any sense, but the collective guilt does. Even our guy Falada, who's both a victim and opponent of the Nazi regime, is, well, far from innocent.
Yeah, the most damning piece of evidence that shows that his views on the Nazis haven't always been so cut and dry is a letter he writes in October of 1933. The recipient is a superfan of his, and an unemployed librarian who has right nationalist tendencies.
There you go. You'd be surprised what a high percentage of Nazis were unemployed librarians.
Well, if this guy was already going there, Falada just pushes him further in that direction. In the letter, Falada writes,
"Quite honestly, if I knew a way of joining the National Socialist Party at the moment without a lot of fuss, I would do it. Because this is my sincere belief. While one can argue about details, this is the party which will save Germany from chaos."
Well, okay. So much for his country's hour of ignominy and affliction.
Yeah. Some of this could just be Falada's typical cowardly people-pleasing, with him telling the superfan what Falada thinks he wants to hear. But maybe he did actually believe some of what he wrote. In most all of his books, he's sort of a barometer for the thoughts and experiences of the German everyman, or little man, if you will.
Aryan little men, presumably. Although I thought Aryan men were supposed to be tall, blonde, and strong?
Well, regardless of his height, Falada's perspective is indicative of the German little man in 1933. After years of inflation, unemployment, violence, and the breakdown in governance, many Germans who still care about other human beings hold their noses and support the Nazis because they believe the Nazis are the only ones strong enough to clean up the mess.
I suppose one could make the argument that after getting turned in by his neighbors for making anti-Nazi jokes, he's just being overly careful here. This librarian guy, who he doesn't actually know, is, if not already a Nazi, then definitely Nazi-leaning. So maybe he's just playing it safe by writing this.
It could be, and if it were a few years later, I'd absolutely say that was the reason. But the Gestapo are new in 1933, and they don't yet have all their totalitarian systems of control in place.
Well, sure, but I mean, his fear could have been that the librarian was going to knock on him.
Yeah, it's possible. But whatever the reason, whether he really was stupid enough to believe what he wrote, or if he just wrote it as a means of feigning support because he was scared, the words themselves are hard to get up from. I mean, these days we pull up tweets that somebody wrote when they were a teenager to show what a horrible person they are and will forever always be. Now, I like to think that the listeners to this podcast have nuanced worldviews that value compassion, tolerance, and forgiveness for their fellow human. But I mean, forgiving someone for quoting homophobic rap lyrics when they were 14 is a bit different than forgiving an intelligent, adult man for espousing private, albeit lukewarm, support for the Nazis. And okay, the Nazis weren't yet fully what they would become, but still. So, how do we and how should we judge him today?
We'll get deeper into these questions later, but for now, I'd like to offer some defense. And that's that after this instance in 1933, there's almost no evidence for anything that could be construed as Falada supporting the Nazis, and plenty of evidence to show that he hates them, deeply.
Yes, privately, that is. Publicly, of course, it's a different matter. He still needs to eat and drink, and therefore he still needs to publish.
Martha Dodd, an American journalist who, incidentally, is one of the main characters in Eric Larson's In the Garden of Beasts, visits Falada on his farm in 1934. She writes of him, quote, "Though I got the impression that he was not and could not be a Nazi, what artist is, I felt a certain resignation in his attitude." She goes on, "He is one of the remaining authors of recognized talent writing in Germany, and one can watch as time goes on what this intellectual and emotional passivity will do to his talent."
In the decade plus between the publication of Once a Jailbird and the end of the war in the Third Reich, Falada will publish a dozen books that include novels, memoirs, and children's stories. While there's one great novel published in this period, most of his work is a step or many steps down from both his pre- and post-Third Reich writings. But I'm not so sure that it's his intellectual or emotional passivity that's to blame. Rather, it's censorship and the fear of offending people that could end both his livelihood and his life that cause him to abandon much of the stark realism he's best at and instead write idyllic portraits of country life, meant to be memoirs that were actually more fiction than fact.
Writing in a totalitarian society is an art unto itself. Most of the best examples are Soviet dissident writers who also turn to sci-fi and fantastical worlds to disguise the protest. I'm thinking, of course, of Bulgakov with Heart of a Dog and The Master of Margarita, and Yevgeny Zamyatin, who wrote the ultimate totalitarian dystopia, We. But I guess Falada wasn't the greatest sci-fi writer?
You'd be surprised, actually. In his prison diary from 44, he's got some fantasy dream sequences that are actually pretty brilliant. But no, in general, he's much better at depicting reality.
But as the years go on, it gets harder and harder to do that. In 1935, he's declared an undesirable writer, which means that his books can't be published abroad. Falada fears that this is a sign that if he doesn't start writing books the Nazis like, he'll soon be banned in Germany too.
These fears, which are all very legitimate, are taking a toll on our little man. He's back on and off the sauce, and while he stays away from morphine during these years, there's also coke, sleeping pills, and plenty of cigarettes. Remember our last episode I asked you to come up with a number for how many cigs our guy was smoking a day? Well, now's the time to tweet us with your guess, and the closest answer gets a basket of assorted tubers. To give you some context, though, before you two guess, I want to mention two legendary smokers. First, there's Vladimir Nabokov, who in his introduction to his novel Ben Sinister boasts that while writing the novel in 1945, he was enjoying a period of exceptional health in which he was smoking 4 packs a day, so 80 cigarettes. And then you've got my friend, the street bookseller, Polish Joe Smoker of 100 cigarettes. That's his name, Polish Joe Smoker of 100 cigarettes. And while it's sometimes abbreviated to just Polish Joe, his last name is Smoker of 100 cigarettes for a reason. That number in one day is Herculean.
All right, I'll go first. 120. The way you set it up means it's more than those two, so I'm guessing Lucky Hans was smoking 6 packs a day.
I feel like it's going to be more. I don't know, maybe 150? But think about that. If you sleep, say, 6 hours, then that's like 8 cigarettes an hour every hour. It's absurd.
And yet you're both low.
No.
200 a day, they say. During the height of his addiction, our little man was puffing down 200 cigarettes a day.
Jesus Christ. That means he's smoking while he eats, while he shits, and even while he has sex with big Sue's.
Or with the local prostitutes he's paying for sex.
That's not waiting for the cancer to kick in. That's like attempting immediate death by cigarette.
The poor guy's nerves are completely shot, and as a result, he makes regular visits to sanatoriums. He's always collapsing from lack of sleep and suffering from stomach ulcers and migraines. His medicine, booze, pills, and cigarettes, is also the cause of these problems. And eventually it's back to the sanatorium.
Yeah, no wonder he can get it together to leave.
You say that in jest, but it's true. In these years, he does attempt to muster the courage to leave Germany, and once he and his family even pack their things to go. But when one is struggling that much with addiction and mental illness, just getting through the day is hard enough.
That's always the big misconception about addicts. Everyone on the outside thinks, what's the matter with him? Why doesn't he stop using so that he can show up for work on time? Or stop going into that dangerous neighborhood to buy drugs? Minor things that to a healthy person seem simple and obvious can be next to impossible for an addict in the throes of addiction. And after all my reading about Falada, I really think this is the main reason he didn't leave. He simply couldn't get his shit together enough to make such a big move.
The one lasting success he has during the Third Reich years is a novel called Wolf Among Wolves, which, like Little Man, is a scathing look at the hardships of life during the Weimar era of hyperinflation and unemployment. It passes Nazi censorship and even receives praise from Goebbels because all the social injustices in the book can be blamed on the former government, from which, in theory, the Nazis have saved the German people.
The book is populated by criminals, gamblers, and whores, i.e. Falada's people. But this is basically the last time he's able to write about them during the Third Reich. The Nazis, the most upstanding, morally pure people in history, don't want to see these kinds of degenerates in their fiction. They want stories of happy, healthy, white families who work the land and raise happy, healthy, white children.
In Falada's words,
I've been practically forbidden to depict shady characters. Only the good, pure and decent. But that produces no problems that are worth depicting.
Does this sound familiar to anyone?
You're not suggesting that something similar is happening today, are you?
What? That they just published new editions of Roald Dahl books where depictions of the witches being fat and ugly and female have been cut out to not offend fat, ugly, or female people?
Well, I was thinking of book bans in schools in the US, you know, books that might have descriptions of gay sex, or, God forbid, acknowledge the existence of trans people.
Right. The Nazis saved their children from the impure and indecent, and we save ours from gay sex and trans people, as well as unflattering fictional depictions of imaginary characters.
Well, I'm glad at least that American children are safe from all that horrible stuff.
Anyhow, as a result of these constraints, most of Falada's Nazi-era work is garbage.
Thank God the constraints contemporary writers are working under are not having a similar effect.
Yeah, thank God. So in 1937, Falada attempts to return to realism by writing another historical novel. This one has actually been commissioned by the Reich Minister for Public Enlightenment and Propaganda himself, Mr. Joseph Goebbels. It's a story of a German family that spans from 1914 to 1928, and it is mostly about the effects of the First World War on the family and society at large.
Emil Jannings, who's one of the biggest stars of German cinema at the time, is chosen to play the lead in the film version. He loves the novel, but Goebbels has one major problem with it. The book ends in 1928, 5 years before the Nazis came to power.
So he basically tells Falada, extend it to 33 to show that the Nazi rise to power is the happy ending the whole world was waiting for, or else.
Essentially, yeah. When Falada balks at making the changes, Goebbels says, if Falada still does not know his attitude to the party has no doubts about its attitude to him.
And so the hero of the story converts to Nazism and all the social wrongs are righted by the arrival of the Third Reich. Falada justifies his capitulation by writing,
I do not like grand gestures, being slaughtered before the tyrant's throne, senselessly, to the benefit of no one and to the detriment of my children. That is not my way.
As this episode comes to an end, we leave our hero, Lucky Hans, at yet another low point in his life. He's writing Nazi propaganda, struggling with addiction, and smoking 200 cigarettes a day. Next week, on the fourth episode of Little Man, What Now? The Life and Times of Hans Falada, his life will reach new depths of despair, from where he'll write, of course, his best books.
Penknife is created, written, and produced by Corey Eastwood, Ramona Stout, and me, Santiago Lemoine. Hans Falada is voiced by Finn Lopsin. The sound design, music, and all things audio are the work of Diego Sanchez of La Pianola Studio in Buenos Aires. The logo and all things visual have been made by Nelly Cuellar Torres. Flor Lopez built our website, penknifepodcast.com, where you can find a full bibliography of the works we used in researching this episode. And again, thanks to Elurbster for letting us turn his spare bedroom into a recording studio. If you like what you're hearing and want to help us out, the best thing you can do right now is to rate and review Penknife on Apple Podcasts, subscribe on whatever platform you're using to listen to us right now, and tell your friends about the show. We're not going to lie to you. We've made these 3 seasons ourselves with very little financial support, and it's been a struggle. We really want to continue to make Penknife, but in order to do so, we need your likes and reviews. Even if you think it's shit and you just want to chime in to tell us to stop wasting our time and money making this podcast, we'd love to hear it.